It may take me a while to find my center after that hymn. It always moves me literally to tears because it expresses a hope that I want to sign on to. But it's so hard. It is so hard. Today is Yom HaShoah, the day of remembering the Shoah, the Holocaust. And we remember this not in order to feel bad as human beings. And it's commemorated in the Jewish community not in order to feel victimhood and to revel in the pain. It is an opportunity that we human beings are driven to try to take our pain and give it meaning, to take the catastrophes and somehow not transcend the pain, but transform it into learning and into change. The lines from Boris Pasternak in Quiet Flows the Dawn keep going through my head. When will we ever learn? When will we ever learn? How long do these cycles of violence and revenge have to go on? And do they have to go on? I grew up unprotected from the world and its pain. My family did not try to protect me from the horrors of what we then called the Holocaust. I remember seeing an early TV in the early 1950s in black and white, the bulldozers pushing bodies around and stacking them as if they were cordwood and not people, and bulldozing them into ditches. And these were the victors handling the terrible pain and the catastrophe that was left in those camps dead. I also remember looking into the eyes of the survivors, and I say that with a question in my voice, because when you looked into those starving faces, those glazed eyes, free of expression, looking at them, it was as if they were paralyzed, and their gaze, as I locked my eyes into theirs on the screen, paralyzed me. It was enough to stop your heart. How do we do this to each other? I knew that they were that way, that those people had been turned into bodies, into corpses, that those starving people had been starved. Most of the faces I looked at and the stories my family told were about the Jews to whom that happened. And I could not understand how we do that to other human beings. I could not understand how the world let that happen. In my youth and, I guess, naivete, I thought that the world could not have known. It must have been ignorance. It must have been a lack of information. I believe, as I grew a little older, along with Socrates, that evil is only the absence of knowledge. And if we knew the good, that we would do it. I denied the capacity that human beings have to do evil, to erase the humanity of other people, and to see them as less than human, as not really one of us, whoever the us is. I knew that this ability, this human, inhuman ability to erase another person as a person, to pull their cards, to suspend their certificate of human birth, is something that has happened again and again in the past. I knew that we could do those things, but I didn't understand, and I still don't understand how we do it. I guess I understand war. I understand aggression. I understand you got that ranch, I want that ranch, I'm going to denounce you, I'm going to betray you. I understand theft. I understand the rational, if inhuman, incentives to war. But I believed that when I heard that phrase, never again, that it was a promise that the world made not simply to Jews. It couldn't just be to Jews. It had to be for everyone. That the world had to have learned something, and that the idea of genocide, the wiping out of a whole people, a genus, some category of people, that's surely something that we could not do. The German word for this program of annihilation was called Vernichtung, to turn into nothing. How do you take a group of human beings, any group of human beings, and turn them into nothing? I knew that certainly this had been done in this country with slavery and not seeing black people as fully human. We took away their cards. Oh, well, you might kind of look like one of us, but you're not really. I knew that the genocide of the Armenians, they were slaughtered for being, well, Armenian. I understood that in the 30s, the attempt to exterminate the rather vague category of almost impoverished farmers who owned a couple of cows, the kulaks, in the Soviet Union, where they were herded up, and some were killed and others put into camps and worked to death, was a terrible foreshadowing of what would later happen during the Holocaust, except it wasn't high tech. I knew that we had this history as human beings, but I thought, surely we have learned. Surely the world could not do that again, and that never again must mean never again for every group, every race, every religion, every ethnicity, every tribe. And so clearly it is heartbreaking every year at Holocaust Remembrance Day, and now this coincides with the Armenian genocide this year, to see how little the world seems to have learned, and how often in the past 70 years that promise, a promise that I thought the world made to the world, has been broken. The world stood by, seemingly helpless, as Rwanda hacked itself apart with machetes. But Rwanda was too poor, maybe too black, to attract our moral compasses. Maybe they didn't have oil or uranium, and that was their real sin. During Mao's great leap forward, millions died. And we did nothing because China was too big for us to interfere with. One's too small, one's too big. Is there no atrocity that is just right? Maybe Serbs against Croats got our moral compasses moving a little bit, but Europe, that should have learned something from the Holocaust, stood by arguing about which side to take and dithering. And human beings killed human beings again because of ethnicity and religion. When you looked at those starving people in some of the camps, most of them were Muslim. The Croats were killed, the Serbs were killed, and the Muslims were singled out for particular horrors. And it took a long time for the world, right at the edge of Europe, to do something. I am not arguing that we have to be involved in every fight. I'm not arguing for an interventionist policy where we arm ourselves and go into every conflict and every outrage, but we cannot avert our eyes. We cannot cover our souls and protect ourselves from what is going on. Denial is not an answer any more than killing to stop killing is a good answer. I wish that I had a single and simple good answer. Oh, if the world would only. But the bad news is this. If you believe in evolution, and I'm going to assume that almost everybody in this room does, we're the winners. We are the boss predators. We survive. And we survive by cooperating, often in war, developing a technology, often for the hunt or for war. We survived our own personal, particular DNA as human beings, survived because we could cooperate and we could be clever and we could deceive. And those were survival benefits up to a time, and they aren't anymore. Those things that got us out of the primordial soup may put us into a very hot and boiling soup if we don't learn how to deal with our differences, how to deal with our envies and our hatreds, and our way of erasing the humanity of other human beings based on their religion, what we perceive to be their race, their identification, and their ethnicity. What is most troubling in the Shoah, in the Holocaust, is not that there is something special and evil intrinsically about Germans. If I believed that, I would be doing what the Nazis did and saying, there's a category of inherently, intrinsically, morally flawed people who are not like us. The terrible lesson is it was done not by Germans, but by people. It was actively done by people and acquiesced to by other people. And these weren't savages. That's where you like to look at other terrible events and say, well, they're sad. What do you expect? That's the Balkans. That's Africa. That's Borneo or Indonesia. The heart of Western civilization, of civilizations with education, with culture, with music, with poetry, cultures that we have exalted and held up, a culture that believed in God. And if culture was not protective of our terrible ability to erase the humanity of Jews, of gypsies, of handicapped, and religion was not effective in staying the bloodlust, where shall we look to find some hope? That's why I moved to tears by that song. I believe in sunlight, even when it's cloudy. I do. And yet, it's so hard to stay the passions, the instincts to see that other as fundamentally different and flawed and less than ourselves. And it's so hard to think and exercise good moral judgment when the epinephrine, the norepinephrine, the adrenaline is flowing in our bloodstream, and those fight, flight, freeze reactions are going on, and our moral compasses are frozen, and our bodies yearn to go out and do something violent because that person, that group, they're at fault. The history of humanity is that it can be any group. and can be perpetrated by any group. There is no immunity. It's not an immunity that any religion has, that any racial group has, that any nation has. This means to me that my greatest hope for the future is that we learn to pause. We learn to do two things. When I was young and naive, as opposed to being older and a little less naive, I think, I thought that the answer was in understanding. If we get to know the Russians and know that they have children, then maybe we can make peace, for a decade or two anyway. If we get to know the adversary or the people we take as an adversary and see their humanity, we will always hold that humanity in us. And yet the very worst and most violent wars tend to be civil wars. The greatest feuds tend to be family feuds. So that's only half of it. We need to know all of the others, all of the other religions and races and ethnicities and political persuasions. But there's a second step. We have to know ourselves. We have to know our capacity for irrational behavior and misbehavior. Our capacity to rationalize our rage, our anger, our violence, and turn war into holy wars, and that's an oxymoron. We may have to fight, but it's never a holy war. Taking a life is never a holy act. Turning another human being into a thing in our heads allows us to turn them into things in front of us, so they become categories of enemies. Half the battle is out there and seeing the other as us. The other half is seeing ourselves. This is not a universal solution I offer you or an easy one, but I believe that the second half of what we need to do is like a 12-step program. To be in touch with what our impulses are, and as an act of will, after a frank and fearless inventory of our prejudices, our impulses, to say, just today, I'm not going to rage. Maybe tomorrow I'll slip and fall, but today I'm not going to rage. Just today I'm going to see an adversary, not as an enemy. Just today, I will look at those people arrayed against my interests and values, not as dogs and vermin and scum, and all those names that we use to actively diminish the humanity of the other. And I believe when we do that, we actively diminish the humanity in ourselves. Just today, I'm going to see my potential for inhumanity. And just today, I'm going to see the humanity in all of my fellow human beings. It's a hard call, and I can't promise never again. For me, for my people, for my community, for all of my communities, I know how hard it is in this world where people find that other. People who have lived together for years. Sunni and Shia, and for most of the 20th century, got along. But something fractures, and all of a sudden, the other isn't even human. What we choose to do, whom we choose to hate, how we can choose to forgive and embrace are important for our world, for the larger society, but also for ourselves. When I was looking into those hollow eyes in my very young youth, when I was seeing all of that horror and that terror, I didn't know how personalized it would become for me, with my mother-in-law and my wife's family being Holocaust survivors, my wife born in a DP camp in Germany, her mother and her aunts and uncles with tattoos on their arms. I had no idea how personal it would be. Also had no idea of how we human beings handle disaster. How some of her family were killed. Some of her family were spiritually killed. That they never recovered. They could not look back without being drawn and fascinated and obsessed by all of the pain of the past. Kind of like Lot's wife, covered in a carapace of tears, dried salt, as she looked back at her past horrors. But most of them were able not to forget the past, not to forgive those who had harmed them, but to balance it and to take it and to move forward, to have lives, to have families, to leave the burden of the pain, not the burden of memory, but the burden of the pain that was paralyzing, and to move forward to engage life. We will never have a perfect world. We will commit atrocities as human beings. We will do inhuman things. But we need to be not stuck in the pain and the guilt of the past, but to acknowledge it as human, to acknowledge its potential in ourselves so that we don't separate even from the perpetrators, but understand that we carry these common traits, and then learn how to learn. Learn how to live. Learn how to move forward from the mistakes, from the errors, from the atrocities, and embrace each other in our fragility and our ferocity. Those are two parts of the human condition. And if we repress them, suppress them, deny them, they will bubble out. If we're willing to look at ourselves, look at our world, and just one day at a time, choose to look into the eyes of the other and see a human being, a sister, a brother, a member of the same species with the same rights to have their inherent dignity recognized. It's not the same as approval. I've run into trouble on this inherent dignity because can you do something so bad that I don't have to look at your dignity anymore? You can do something so bad that I may really revile you. But if I get caught up in that self-justification, I am diminishing me. So I ask for spiritual honesty and spiritual generosity for the sake of the world, but for my own safety's sake and the sake of my fragile soul. I don't get a choice about how every other human being acts and reacts. I have some choice, not unlimited, but some choice about what I do with this beautiful, broken, wounded world that we are called upon to embrace, to make just a little bit better. Perfection will elude us in fixing the world, and it will elude us in fixing ourselves. But there are things that we do that count. This is a kind of community where we come together to affirm our values, to find ways of making a difference. A little difference, sometimes a big difference, but we can't know. When we simply try to do the right thing that express our best examined values, we have the best chance of making a good difference. It's not an all or nothing world. Our crop walk will not feed the rest of humanity for the rest of time. It will feed some people this week, this month, and that's enough. Give people a chance. I'll close with a story that I've told before. It's about my mother-in-law. And when one of our grandsons was getting married, we asked her for her guest list. And she put somebody on the guest list whose name we didn't recognize. And we said, "Ma, who is this person? You know how much it costs to feed a face at a wedding?" And what's she doing there? And she said, well, she saved my life at Auschwitz. She gave me a piece of bread. That doesn't mean that it guaranteed that my mother-in-law would live through the war, or through the month, or through that day. The person who gave that bread could never know what that piece of bread meant. And we, incidentally, she got the invitation, and we can never know what our individual acts of kindness, of generosity, of bread, of love, of forgiveness can mean to another human being, their family, their tribe, their religion, their ethnicity, our world.